it's an interesting topic that we could get a nice discussion going on. Let me start by talking a little bit about what I was asked to talk about, which is a little bit, it may be a little bit ahead of the curve. I don't know if people's heads are here yet. But it's kind of, I guess, a combination in the week after Dubai and those kinds of tragedies in terms of terror, coupled with what's happening in the financial world. How do you talk to your kids, specifically this is supposed to be focused on adolescents, I think, about difficult financial times, or about difficult times, about terror? And it's something that basically I'm going to talk about three basic guidelines, and then I'd love to get a discussion going. So in terms of the basic guidelines, number one is that one size doesn't fit all. I mean, all the research shows that there's no one way to handle coping, right? There's some kids are talkers, some kids are avoiders. For many, many years, I was director of psychology at North Shore Hospital. And when we had kids, let's say, who were struggling with an illness like cancer, and we have to go and give them some kind of painful medical procedure, we knew, and the research shows, there are kids who are distractors, where they would distract themselves, and they wouldn't want to know anything about why we're giving them a painful shot. And they wouldn't want to talk about it, they wouldn't want to hear about it. We'd have special game systems we'd wheel into them, and they just want to play with the game systems. Kids on the other end of the continuum were attenders. Those were kids who would want to talk about it to the point of nausea. They'd want to know why they couldn't have another doctor. They'd want to know why they couldn't have some alternative form of treatment. And what the research shows on distractors versus attenders is if you take a distractor, somebody who distracts themselves and needs to not talk about it, and you kind of force them to talk about it, or vice versa. Let's say you shove the game system in the hand of the attender, they actually do much worse. The story I've told about this in a number of situations is the story of I was in Israel after 9/11. My main secular area is post-traumatic stress disorder. I was involved in developing the diagnosis and in doing a fair amount of writing about it. So I get invited to talk about trauma and to deal with trauma in different parts of the world, from Sri Lanka to after the tsunami to Beskar Mahalonatata. Sometimes you have to take care of your own more than anything. And I was in Israel at the height of the Intifada, giving a lecture to a group of about 50, 60 trauma specialists in Jerusalem. And it just happened to be that as I'm giving the lecture, word came in about the bombing in the Hebrew University cafeteria. And they were totally understaffed. Yerushalayim is like an overgrown bungalow colony, and the whole wider Israel, calls were coming in. And pretty soon the whole center was emptied out of their therapists. And the director of the center asked me if I would go with an Israeli colleague to a place where, in the middle of the country, where the madricha of the program, there were 40 adolescents in the program, madricha of the summer program had just been killed in the pigua. And they said that the kids had just been told, and they asked if I could go and spend the day with the kids to sort of help them through it with my Israeli colleague. When we got there, they put me in a corner of the room with the Israeli colleague, and they told the kids there are 5 coping rooms because they understand it's not one size fits all. There was a writing room where they wrote letters to the parents of the woman who was killed. Then there was a talking room where they spoke with us. There was a music room, an art room, and a davening room. And the kids divided themselves equally among 4 of the 5 rooms. They were allowed to go from room to room, but not a single kid switched from one room to another room. The kids who wanted to talk, talked. A quarter of the kids came to talk to us, and they spent the whole day talking. And the music kids did music, and the art kids did art, and the writer kids wrote. None of them chose the tefillah room, which is typical of adolescence. It's the lowest point of religious development in some ways, the research shows. Girls may be a little bit different. It's a complicated literature, but that didn't surprise me at all. And what was fascinating to me was what worked for one kid. So if a kid is upset about whatever it is they're upset about, you have to go, and it's what all the research shows, you have to go and work with that style, and then expand out from that. So the week after I go, I'm back from Israel, and I'm giving a talk related to 9/11. This was in 2002 in Manhattan, and I tell over this story of the five coping rooms. And a woman raises her hand and says the following story, which I'll never forget. She says that the week before, she was at a lecture given by Elie Wiesel. And her father, who's a Vishnu Chassid, who was still alive, was an adolescent with Mr. Wiesel in the concentration camp. They were in the same bunk. And they, she figured maybe he'll remember her father, and her father had sent regards. So she waits online after the talk and goes to speak to Mr. Wiesel. And she says to Mr. Wiesel, do you remember my dad? And she says her father's name. And he starts to cry. He says, what do you mean, do I remember your father? He saved my life. So she says, he never told me anything about that. And here's the story that Mr. Wiesel said. And with that, I'll end the coping thing. There are three, four things I wanted to focus on. He said there was a horrible day, even by concentration camp standards. It was just horrible. It was cold. They were being tortured. We all know what happened to people in those horrible years. And a group of Russian prisoners of war got a hold of some rat poison and decided to kill themselves. So they were waiting online, each patiently waiting to take their turn at the rat poison to lay down and die. Adolescence is a time of life that suicide is unfortunately most contagious. I've often been asked to speak in this area after certain tragedies about that issue. This is, in some ways, a much easier issue to talk about. So the adolescents all joined the line, right behind the Russian prisoners of war, including Elie Wiesel, fully intending to take his life, fully intending, and all of them. He said every adolescent but your father joined the line. He said your father, the Chassid, retained his faith even in that horrible place. And he goes off to the side of the line, and he breaks into this ancient Vishnu Sanigan of Ani Mamin Be'emuna Shlema Be'Vias HaMashiach, I believe in ultimate redemption. And the song broke our suicidal spell. One by one, we left the line. One by one, we surrounded your father and joined him in song. And go home and remind your father, the only reason I live to do what I've done is because of that song he sung that day. So coping comes in a lot of different flavors. And again, study after study, I've been privileged to co-develop psychotherapy program for adolescents going through tough times with some federal support. And it's interesting because what we find is that when you're sensitive to this one issue, it's something that's being marketed, it's being piloted in 30 sites across the country and getting very good results. So a couple of states have adopted it for their foster children. And one of the things we do is we have a list of 13 coping mechanisms that adolescents use going through tough times. And we actually try to expand their repertoire, but we start with what fits for them. So we'll show them like an upsetting movie, or we'll talk about an upsetting topic if that's something that they want to talk about. And then we have a table filled with examples of those 13 coping mechanisms. So they'll have lotions to put on or comic books to read if they want to distract themselves, or sports magazines or iPods or any one of a host of those 13 ways of coping. And what's amazing is that it speaks to them. So after they have this, let's say we show them an upsetting clip, a 10-minute clip of a movie, they'll go and they'll grab the different coping mechanism materials and they'll use it, and we then ultimately come up with a toolbox of coping mechanisms with them, and they actually carry it around in a little satchel that we help prepare for them. So actually Illinois just adopted this program, mandated for all their foster children, because they find that it lengthens the length of stay in foster care so they don't switch from foster home to foster home. Because it speaks to what kids have to do. As Rav Hirsch said, it's not Kaylee, Lama Azavtani, it's Lama Azavtani. When you change the question from why to what am I going to do with it? It really helps. So let's bring it to the mundane. I'm talking about horrible things. I'm talking about the Holocaust. I'm talking about a pigua. I'm talking about terror. I'm talking about pretty horrible times. What about day-to-day stress? What about something as normal as financial stuff? And there are some scary things. There are a number of kids whose parents have faced layoffs, and that could be very frightening to a kid. There's some research that shows the long-term impact on that. if you want, we could talk about that. But the reality is that as these things happen and kids hear about them, the key is to just ask them, how you doing? Every once in a while, check in with them. Ask them how they're coping. Ask them how they're doing with their difficult times. And just by checking in on them and giving them a way of saying, hey, am I worried about it? If they say I'm not worried about it, fine. You let them be. A lot of adolescents have no interest in talking to their parents about what they're worried about. But if they're not worried about it, then it makes a lot of sense to try to figure out how to, basically to give them a voice. What we find is that when you give children a voice to talk about what it is that they're upset about. I have a colleague who I've done a lot of writing with who's a Harvard psychiatrist. And he was treating a psychiatrist who was caught in the stairwell on 9/11 and just managed to get away with his life. So the guy is in treatment with him, and he takes a picture of him using an fMRI, which is a technique where as this guy had a flashback to that horrible day 7.5 years ago, he showed me a picture of what the brain looks like when it's reliving its most horrible moment. And when you look at it, what you see is you're rendered speechless. Literally, Broca's area is shut down. The language centers of the brain are totally shut down. And then what this colleague shows is that the way you help somebody overcome tough times is you light up Broca's area. You give them words. You give them a way to talk about it, and that's where healing comes from. Now, at a much lower level, just reaching out to kids. Give them words to talk about what they're upset about. Reaching out to them. Just something as simple as asking them how they're doing, giving them a chance to articulate it. Find out what's working for them. If they are upset, if they're not upset, just let them know that you're there just in case. That simple thing with an understanding that there's that whole array of different ways of coping and respecting their way of coping makes an enormous difference. Okay, so that's part one of the three main points I want to make. Any questions about that before I move on to the next two points? So you got the coping mechanism stuff? You're okay? Okay. Part two is actually it's obvious, but it's important to talk about, and it's the kids listen. They you have to monitor their exposure, and even adolescents who seem very sophisticated and seem to know it all, they sometimes misunderstand or hear things and worry about it in a much more concrete way because they have no real life experience to calm them down. So what I mean by that is, for example, in terms of monitoring conversations around the house, is that, or monitoring TV exposures, we know, for example, the kids who are very anxious or kids who are worriers or just kids in general, they may misunderstand what they hear. If you're worried about, you know, that X percentage of your portfolio is down, or you're worried about the security of a job, or you're worried about anything. Again, you hear about, God forbid, a terror attack like the horrible week that we had last week collectively in the Jewish world. Just to understand that kids, especially sensitive, anxious kids, do much better if you expose them, if possible, to as little media as possible. You shouldn't have CNN going on all week if you have an anxious kid at home. The more auditory the exposure, like radios, the better than if it's visual exposure, like television. There are numerous studies done after 9/11, including with adolescents and after the Oklahoma City bombing, that showed the more kids were exposed to heavy TV watching about the news of 9/11 or Oklahoma City, the worse their recovery over five to seven, 8 year period. So monitoring that exposure and understand. I'll tell you a story with a younger kid that I just heard. I got a call from a colleague who's working, who does work with kids who are going through tough. Well, no, maybe I won't. It's too depressing a story. I'm telling you depressing stuff. I won't tell you this story. But the idea is that I'll tell you a more more generic idea. If a kid hears that you're concerned about financial problems, in their head, they're literally worried about being homeless, even adolescents. They don't understand that even in the worst-case scenario, virtually everybody in our community is still going to have a roof over their head. Even if a house is foreclosed, you're going to have a place to live. you know, I mean, I don't know of many scenarios where people in our community end up at the point that they don't have a place to live. Worst case scenario is you move back with parents, or you move back with a sibling, or the community helps set you up in a different place to live. But kids often react and worry about, especially when they're in the 50% of the population that's very anxious, they often react in a way that they're worried in real time about far, far more dire consequences than we know about. Okay? So that's why it's very important. Check in with them, ask them how they're doing, find out what they're worried about, and reassure them. Don't give them false reassurance, but talk to them about it, because very often they may be more worried about it. Again, I can tell you story after story where kids are more worried about this stuff than they need to be, and they just need to understand that no matter what, things are gonna, you know, things are ultimately gonna be okay. Okay? And also, I guess a lot of times people, when they're talking, they're not tuned in to how much kids are overhearing. There are a number of longitudinal studies that look at what does it take to raise a kid to be a mensch? What does it take to raise a kid to internalize our values? And in these studies, what they find is that one of the key predictors of mensch making is the sensitivity to adults of what it is that they're talking around the Shabbos table about. So if around the Friday night table, a Shabbos afternoon table, when you have guests, you're speaking about disagreeing with the school or the rabbi or whatever, or other people you disagree with, and you're not being sensitive to the fact that your kids are listening in, it actually is associated with problems. The key is to talk about even people you disagree with in a way that shows respect for their perspective. So the importance of monitoring perspective and showing respect for those you disagree with is a key point in transmitting a sense of security to kids. That's the way they learn. Who do you want your kids to marry one day? Do you want them to marry somebody who comes from a home where there's respect for other people's point of views? Or to marry somebody who comes from a home where there's no respect for other people's point of view. So that's one of the key predictors of success in marriage. And it happens all the time. I was once talking about this. I was a scholar in residence in a community in Queens. And the rabbi, who was the new rabbi in that particular shul, came over to me. He said he had just started in the shul a couple of weeks earlier. And somebody came over to him and said, called him, and said that their son was intermarrying, which was very unusual in that community, particularly since the kid had had a yeshiva education through high school. And the parents were very active in the community, so he called the kid in to just talk to the kid, because the kid had made up his mind to intermarry, and even though he didn't know him, he thought he owed it to the parents, even though he was new, to talk to them. So the kid said, look, he said, obviously it's very complicated why I'm doing this, but I'll tell you why I think I didn't internalize the values of my home or my yeshiva. He said, my parents are very busy. They're hardly around. The only time I'd see them was two meals a week, Friday night meal and Shabbos meal. They always had company, or we were always invited out. He said, for as long as I can remember, all I could remember my parents talking about is how much they hated the school and how much they hated the shul rabbi. That's all I heard. He said, how do you expect me to see this religion? All I've been exposed to is complaining. And he didn't even know what to answer, because that's what kids absorb true lessons through the right hemisphere, through nonverbal learning, which Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky says, parents aren't mechanchim, they're not educators, they're mashpiim. Mashpiim comes from the Hebrew word shipua, a ramp. It's what ramps down to kids unconsciously, and we don't even know we're teaching them. We don't even know what they're hearing. And that's what kids absorb. In this context, what am I talking about? I'm talking about this even in benign conversation around the Shabbos table with family, talking about this law firm laying off or this financial, whatever. They're talking about whatever, because there isn't a single area that I know of that hasn't been touched by what's been happening. And kids, especially adolescents, because adolescents know just enough to worry and sometimes to take responsibility for things, but they often do get things wrong. And they rush to judgment and often will not share with parents what they're worried about. And that, again, shows why it's important to monitor exposure in that kind of way. Okay? Any thoughts about this before I move on to the third point? We're okay? Okay. It's unusual. Okay. Okay. Number three. So number three is the issue of what do we know is protective. So what we know is protective is actually, let me slow down a little bit because we have plenty of time, and then I'll get into some very specific kinds of recommendations. There's been a lot of research. It's been done on three islands. It's the purest kind of research. The island of Kauai, Martha's Vineyard, and the Isle of Wight. Okay? And what they do is they look at every kid born on that island. For example, in the Kauai study, in 1955, they look at every single kid born in Kauai in 1955. They follow them into adulthood. At that time in 1955, Kauai was a horrible place to grow up. Anybody ever in Kauai? One of the most unbelievably beautiful places on the earth. And I have a friend who specializes in trauma on that island. He says he couldn't take it. He moved to this part of the world because the contrast between the suffering on that island and the beauty of the island was just too much for him and too much for a lot of people. In 1955, Kauai was a place with tremendous crime, poverty, and abuse. It was very hard to escape it. So they figured this is a good way to understand resilience. And they intensively study every kid born on the island, follow them into adulthood. The study's still going on to see who makes it and who succumbs to the ravages of poverty, abuse, and violence. Any guesses as to what the top three predictors were of resilience? By the way, a third made it, a third were in the middle, and a third succumbed to the the horrible life there. Any guesses about what do you think the top three ingredients would have been? Huh? Father, okay, family, good guess, good. Anything else? What else? So the connection to family.
Education.
That's actually a good guess. Yes, we'll talk about that. And anything else? Education was important, yeah.
Some other person who cares about the child.
Right. So it turns out, and this is a little spooky, because what they did is the number one thing was one person who cares. It could have been a parent. Could have been somebody outside of the family who cared about the kid. Often the parents weren't available. But as long as there was one person, often who the kid recruited, who cared, it made all the difference in the world. So they were really able to take a look at that and able to show what a crucial role that played. I know the guy who's doing this study now, it's still continuing, and that was probably one of the most robust findings. By the way, interestingly, they had nurses go into the baby nursery when the baby was only a few days old. So they had them go into the baby nursery, and they're in the baby nursery, and they rate them at, I think, 3 days for likability. How much chen does the kid have? And it turns out the kids who, as newborns, were rated as high on likability were more likely to be in the resilient third and were more likely to recruit. The question is, can you teach likability? Can you teach that? And that, I believe you can, because that's what some of our, again, in my last 25 years wearing my hat at North Shore Hospital, in our, trauma research team, we sort of, in our, the program I told you about, we were able to show you could probably teach it. There are ways of teaching kids social skills and ways to teach them how to recruit and ways of teaching them how to ask at the right time in the right place. This stuff is teachable, even though it may seem like it's not. I guess I'm an inherent optimist. And optimism is an important thing. So I think that that's a key ingredient. So key ingredient is to one person who cares. So one person who cares. Number two, yeah.
Question,
sure.
When you say one person who cares, when it's not necessarily a parent, is there any sense as to at what ages and how open that person's in the life?
Yeah. I mean, I think it would probably have to be somebody who's there for them on a regular basis. So, for example, in the mentoring, if you're asking as a principal, in the mentoring field, the finding is that they have to be there for a minimum of 6 months ongoing. If they're there, if they pretend that they're going to be there for long term and they abandon the kid before 6 months are up, the kid's better off never. They do worse with them. So it has to be sustained. And it has to be somebody who knows what they're doing in terms of offering support. But what's interesting, it's not so much what they do with the kid as much as just being there. Being there for the kid, believing in the kid, connecting to the kid, the power of connection is an unbelievable thing. It's like an unbelievable thing. So that's number one, is the one person who cares and learning how to do that and how to recruit that person. Number two is active religious beliefs. So those were active churchgoers. This is Kauai. It wasn't New York City. So active churchgoers were more likely to be in the resilient third for obvious reasons. It takes you from passive to active. Anything that takes you from passive to active in terms of dealing with stress, you're going to do much better. There's a beautiful refersh on Kanesher Yor Kino Al Gozol of Yerachev. He asks, why is it the Jews at a time of tsaros are compared to eagles? So they said, because eagles are unique among all the animals. Any other bird, its baby is in danger. The mother swoops down on the bird. The baby's in a passive position. The mother picks up the baby and flies away to safety. Eagles, on the other hand, they fly higher than any other living thing. When a baby eagle is in danger, the mother hovers over the nest. The eagle, the baby, hops on her back, and the mother flies to safety, because on the mother's back, the baby's going to be in the safest place, because there's no way the baby could be hurt, you know, because of where mother eagles fly. So Hirsch says, what's that about? It's unlike any other animal. The babies here are taking an active role in their deliverance. And there's a real, again, in terms of this issue, how do you turn to kids? Any way you could take them from passive to active, it could be it through a chesed program, which I'm getting to, or be it through just doing anything you can to give them a sense of control. It's very much associated with better outcomes. The third ingredient is the ingredient of required helpfulness. So required helpfulness is about, it's a very interesting thing. This is the least intuitive of the ingredients. And there are other ingredients, but a core ingredient is kids who, going through those tough times, were required to pitch in and help without overburdening them. Kids who were asked to do to help out around the house. Kids who were asked to maybe earn a little extra money. Kids who were given chores. But kids who just weren't passively accepting, but asked to give and asked to help out. It turns out that required helpfulness made all the difference in the world. Okay? Because again, it's like that eagle. It's going from passive to active. Now, what's the implication of this? The implication of this in terms of the third ingredient. Okay, so what are the two ingredients we've had until now? So ingredient number one is one size doesn't fit all. Respect the coping style of the kid. Find out how they cope. Ask them, how are you doing? What helps you cope? And then help support that mode of coping, including respecting their right to remain silent if they don't feel like talking to you. What's the name of that best-selling book on parenting adolescents? Mom, would you get out of my life, but first would you take me and Cheryl to the mall, right? The second ingredient we said is what? What's the second ingredient?
Checking in.
It's checking in and monitoring conversations around the house. It's that parenting as shipua, it's the ramp-down effect. So monitoring exposure and also checking in, right? Checking in is how are you doing is part of the coping thing, and then monitoring conversations around the house, monitor exposures, especially for the more anxious kids. The third ingredient is the ingredient of required helpfulness. If you're going to be going through tough times, I don't care if it's a terror attack where you may get the kids to say Tehillim or to take on some project, or required helpfulness. Required helpfulness is basically, how do you get the kids to pitch in? And that's another key kind of point. And let me, before I go to some more specific recommendations, let me end this section with a story. It's one of my favorite stories lately about the issue of required helpfulness. I have many stories about it. But this one is a nice, good, feel-good story. I've said some depressing stories, now I'll give you a feel-good story. There's a woman in the Hasidic community who I'm friendly with. Wonderful woman, a big activist in the community. And she's one of these people who very often, you know, by the way, kids, in the more affluent the community, usually the less kids are asked to do. There's something we psychologists called affluenza. Affluenza is that the highest rate of depression in adolescents in this country are kids who come from homes where there's a lot of money, okay? And that's an important issue, okay? So affluenza is a really scary kind of thing when you think about it. And the antidote to affluenza, in part, is this required helpfulness. There are three reasons why kids from affluent backgrounds and adolescents are at increased risk. So there's this really outstanding set of studies done at Columbia where a psychologist at Columbia compared a large group of kids from a very wealthy school district in Westchester, and then compared them to a large group of kids in like almost like the inner city, kids who are very poor. And he found, totally against expectations, triple the rate of depression, a much higher rate of anxiety disorders, and much more drug abuse and substance abuse. So it made no sense. And then he did a series of other studies trying to figure out, hey, what's this about? What's it about? So the three reasons he came up with for affluenza, based on his research, number one was it's never enough just to be average in those kind of environments. It's never enough just to be average. When's the last time somebody came to Shul and said, guess what? I just got my son's SAT scores, 50th percentile. 50th percentile. That doesn't happen. You don't brag about average performance in our world. Number two is that the parents are often not available. There isn't a lot of time, okay? They're just not around as much because they have high-powered careers, often both parents, and the kids, therefore, a lot is demanded of them, but time is probably the main ingredient through which transmission of values takes place and protection against the stresses of life. And if parents aren't around, it's not going to happen. Great Kutzker, I heard from my father. I think some of you have heard me say this. It says, at the end of Tehillim, Chitzim b'yagibar kem b'nei hanu'urim. So the Kutzker compares raising children to being an archer, the Tehillim, David HaMelech, compares raising children to being an archer. So the Kutzker asks, what's the connection between being an archer and raising children? And he answers that just like an archer, the closer you hold the bow to your heart, the further and straighter the arrow goes, so too with raising children. The closer you hold them to your heart, the more time you spend with them, the further and straighter they go. In the affluenza families in Westchester, that time wasn't there. They had plenty of nannies watching the kids. They had plenty of housekeepers. They had plenty of after-school activities the kids had to partake in, but there wasn't enough one-on-one exposure to parental influences. And then the third thing was lack of required helpfulness, is that the kids were never Olam Chesed Yibana, right? The world is built around kindness, and the kids were never asked to go beyond that sense of entitlement, and that's the recipe for disaster. And again, that's the answer. Again, in what we're going through, it's the answer in terms of resilience building. In fact, in a weird set of studies, they looked at kids who were came of age after the Depression of 1929, and they asked them, what is it that it was a different question. Their theory was the eldest in that family should have had the worst outcomes. Because what happened in a lot of families, the oldest son or the oldest child would have to quit school and go to work to put bread on the table. It's a matter of survival. And because of that, they would put a younger brother or sister through college, through graduate school, but they themselves weren't able to go. So common sense would say that the eldest in a child of depression, the child of the 1920s, 1930s, should have not had a very successful life. Turns out it was the opposite. They were much more successful than any other cohort coming of age during the Depression. Why? Because of the power of required helpfulness, because of the power of jumping on the back of the bird, of the mother bird. I'll go back to the story now. So to go back to the story, you have this poor mother, and she is living in this Hasidic community where there's not a lot of money to go around. In those communities, so often kids are just required to pitch in. It's part of what happens. It's why this professor at Columbia is convinced it's one of the most protective things in the poor communities against the three findings that he had. So what happens is a blind woman moves in to the apartment building next door. Blind from birth, has no parents, they're both dead, and has no husband, no children, and she's all alone, totally helpless. So she turns to her daughter, and she says to her daughter, you know something? She has a 9-year-old, or she has a bunch of kids, but she has a 9-year-old daughter who's incredibly shy. So she turns to her 9-year-old daughter and says, you know what, I want you to go next door twice a week and you read to this woman. That's classic required helpfulness, right? Shy kid, she doesn't want to do it, but she knows she can't argue because her mother's saying that's what you have to do. You have to go next door and you have to read to this woman twice a week. That's required helpfulness. So the little girl goes over and develops a relationship with the blind woman. And after a couple of months of doing this, at the end of one of the reading sessions, the blind woman sighs and she says, In two more years, I'm going to be able to see. 2 more years, I'm going to be able to see. So the little girl asks her, my friend's daughter asks her, what do you mean? I thought you were blind. She says, yeah, I'm blind. But a doctor told me they now have new kinds of laser surgery. They know how to fix my blindness now, but I can't afford it. But in 2 years, I'm going to be 65. I'm going to get Social Security, certain kinds of added benefits. And I'm going to be able to save up enough money to have the operation. Just 2 more years. Little girl doesn't say a word. But she grew up in a community and in a family where you take these things on your own shoulders. She goes to her Hasidic school the next day. And she overcomes her shyness. And she goes from class to class and she mumbles, there's a blind woman in the building next to me. She needs an operation. Blind woman in the building next to me. She needs an operation. I need money. She goes to every class. She comes running to Mrs. Schwartz, the blind woman's apartment, that night, saying, Mrs. Schwartz, I have the money. You know what she has? She has, in this tattered envelope, 83 single dollar bills. 83 singles. So Mrs. Schwartz says, no, she's blind. And she takes poor Mrs. Schwartz, and she takes her with her cane, and there's a firm ophthalmologist around the corner. So she goes around the corner, and they don't have an appointment. The 9-year-old girl and Mrs. Schwartz sit down. And finally, this ophthalmologist finishes with his hours. He comes out to see this woman without an appointment, clearly blind. And this 9-year-old girl, he calls them in, does an exam, and turns to Mrs. Schwartz and says, you're right. You know something? You're 100% right. You're 100% right. You don't have to be blind. I could fix this. And he checks her into the hospital. And he does the surgery, and they do the rehab. The brain has to learn how to see. And however long it takes, however many months it takes, the woman is now sighted. And she goes back to her block in that Hasidic neighborhood. What's the first thing you would do if you go back to that block? You can finally see. What do you do when you go back to that block? What's the first thing you would do? She asks, can you tell me where this little girl lives? She goes to my friend's apartment, and it turns out my friend, her daughter didn't tell her. She didn't tell her. She did. It's just what you do. And she says, do you know what your daughter did? And she tells her, I could see now because your daughter raised the money for my operation. And so my friend goes to her daughter and says, I'm so proud of you. I can't believe you did it. How much money did you raise? She says, $83. We all know $83 won't even pay for the television in the hospital room. It's more like probably $83,000, if not more, for all that rehab and the surgery and the cost of the surgeon. So my friend, she doesn't have money, but she takes responsibility. She goes to the straight to the ophthalmologist, and she waits for him. Again, he finishes his hours, comes out, sees her, calls her in. She says, I'm the mother of that little girl. And she says, look, I have to take responsibility. I don't even know how much money you laid out of your pocket to do this surgery, but I know I owe you a debt. I don't have money. Put me on a payment plan. It may take me 10 years, little by little. I'll pay you a certain amount every week, or I'll raise some money from the community. Just let me know how much I owe you. So he laughs. He says, are you kidding? He says, how often can you do something like restore sight to a woman who's been blind? But he says, can I ask you a favor? And he reaches into his pocket, and he takes out the tattered envelope with the 83 singles, okay? And he says, can I keep this? Can I keep this? And he says, ever since that day that your daughter walked into my office, I've been totally inspired. Totally inspired. And every time I have a tough day, I just reach into my pocket and I feel those 83 singles and it restores my faith in humanity. Okay? That's the essence of that third ingredient, the essence of required helpfulness. So let's pull together. Let's pull together in terms of what we're talking about. What are we talking about? Is we're talking about the three ingredients in terms of reaching out to kids during tough times, be it terror or tough financial times. I don't know how many of you are sort of in the thick of the hurricane here, but we know we're coming in for tough times. If you're lucky enough not to have people working in industries directly impacted, I'm sure that the fallout, we're just at the beginning of something. My friends who were the investment bankers or the partners in the large firms tell me that we're in for a number of very, very tough years, like we've never experienced, like going back to the Depression, maybe. But certainly nothing that we've ever experienced. That's scary. So you have to think about it. You have to think about it because there are ways of reaching out to our adolescents in a way that will minimize risk. So the three ingredients, let's review it. The three ingredients are, number one is respect the coping style of your child, but check in with them. Light up Broca's area, ask them how they're doing. That's number one. Just a simple question, like, how are you doing? How are you doing? Number two is make sure to monitor their exposure, because very often we have exposure without even realizing it. The Baal Shem Tov says, "B'makom marshavto shel adam sham hu nimtza ha'esh." It's all what you're exposed to. You could be through the same tough time, okay? The same tough thing, and experience it totally differently based on the way your parents or the people around you massage that. I have a friend at UCLA who was doing a study after a school shooting in a playground in LA. And there were two kids there. And they were pinned down by the fire. A number of kids were killed in the shooting, but there were two kids. One was very symptomatic, one wasn't. So he's trying to understand, why is this kid not symptomatic? So he calls the kid in, and he says, you're doing so well after the shooting, and, the kid next to him was totally destroyed by what happened, had terrible incapacitating post-traumatic stress disorder. So he said, what's the deal here? So the kid says, He says, yeah, it was scary, but he said, I had an earthquake preparation course the week before, and they told me that if there's ever an earthquake, you have to just sort of like dive for cover. You have to dive for cover, okay? So when it happened, I said, this is a little bit like an earthquake. So I knew what to do. So that's the key. Massage the perceptions. Conversely, I had a call from a colleague who was working with some kids in Israel just a couple of weeks ago, a call from an Israeli colleague who said, was asking for some input on a kid she's seeing who, in her school, she's in a school that's not far from where the rockets fall, in Sderot areas, and they had an alarm. They had an alarm, which was really an alarm. It was like a fire drill, a drill for the rockets. They're not actually in Sderot, but unfortunately, they're getting better at long-range missile lobbing. So the kid believed he was under attack. So he developed, so what you believe. He believed he was under attack, so he developed, even though there was no danger, but because he believed there was danger, it becomes a threat. The 9-year-old kid I told you about in the UCLA study believed he was not under danger. But what the research on resilience building shows is, in terms of that second ingredient, you could massage that perception by massaging exposure and talking to your kids in a way that gives them control, so they're jumping on the back of the eagle. So that's the second key recommendation. And the third recommendation, as I was telling you with that story and telling you with the Kauai study and the Isle of Wight and Martha's Vineyard study, shows the same thing, is it's all about required helpfulness. It's olam chesed yibane, and that makes an enormous difference. Let me end. I could end. I could even do more stories. I have about 100 stories popping through my head. Let me just give you some more specific kinds of recommendations about talking to kids. And then if you want, we'll talk. We have another 15 minutes, or I could bounce off some other thoughts off you. So in terms of the specific set of questions on the first set of recommendations, ask kids how well they believe they're coping, who, if anyone, helps them do this, what they have found to be most effective in dealing with the things that they're worried about, and what they believe would be most helpful in assisting them in dealing with future kinds of worries. The average adolescent probably is not going to want to talk to you. They probably won't tell you very much, and that's fine. But ask them. If you ask them, that's fine. The research shows, so they don't want to talk to you. That's what adolescents do for a living. They rarely do want to talk about these things. But to be able to do that could be very helpful. That set of questions, actually, sometimes you think it's simplistic. I had this unbelievable experience. I was asked to give a talk at a big homeless conference a few years back. And I'm on the dais. Another speaker was a guy who I read his resume. It was an incredible resume. So it's this big ballroom. There are about 400 specialists in dealing with homeless people in the, I think it was mainly an East Coast conference. And I'm reading his resume, and it's, you know, it's very impressive. He's the highest ranking person in the country on setting homeless policies, in charge of that division of the government, PhD from Harvard. He won an Oscar for a documentary he had put together on homelessness. This is a guy who I was just looking forward to hearing the guy speak. And he gets up, and his opening line was one of the most outstandingly incongruous opening lines I ever heard. He really got everybody's attention. Here's his opening line. He says, "When I was 13, my father, in a coked-up rage, killed my mother and then killed himself right in front of me." That's his opening line. I'm burdening you with this horrible image for a reason. Because he goes on to say that he was an only child. He knew about the foster care system. He didn't want to fall in their clutches. And he goes and he spends the next 2 years running away from the authorities because he doesn't want to be part of the foster care system. He wants to be on his own. He values his independence. He looks older than his age. And he said he spent the next 2 years totally having a meaningless, unconnected life. Totally meaningless, totally unconnected. And what does he do? He wanders from shelter to shelter. The second he thinks they're on to how young he is, what does he do? He runs away again. And he wanders throughout the country until finally he said he heard four words that forever changed his life. And he says, when you hear the words, you're going to be disappointed. You're going to be really disappointed. What were the four words? The four words were, he goes into a shelter here on the East Coast, and the director comes over and puts his arm around him and says, "How are you doing? How are you doing?" He says, it wasn't the words. It was the way they were said. I knew he really wanted to listen. He was giving me the undivided attention. This guy really wanted to know. He really wanted to know. It was undivided attention. So I started telling him, he says. I started telling him. And the more I started telling him, right, k'mayim punim al punim kein leifa adam. It's what's bounced back from heart to heart. The more I told him, the more I saw he was interested, and the more I opened up to him. So I totally opened up to him. And he goes on to say that the guy realized that he was pretty smart. And after a few weeks of his unburdening himself to this wonderful man, the man gets him a scholarship at one of the private schools in Manhattan. And from there, he gets a scholarship to Harvard, and from there, his doctorate. He says, all because of those four words. It's as simple as that. Simple as that. How are you doing? So that's that first set of recommendations in terms of that. In terms of talking to children more specifically, is you help them deal with your reaction. There's a lot of research that shows that when you validate, first of all, you validate what they're saying. You don't rush to fix. You validate. In Hebrew, the word ashrei, highest level of happiness, is tied to the word yishur, which is a license or to validate. Something very happy-making about feeling validating and feeling that people get you. It's an important piece of information. So ashrei yishur, ashrei yishur, and also to share with them that in fact, hey, listen, there's a reason why you're upset, and maybe share with them, you know, without overburdening them, share with them a little bit about how you're feeling, what you're worried about. That often actually paradoxically calms them down. Because they're always imagining a lot worse. So when you light up Broca's area, like that earlier story I told you, it really makes a difference. And to open up, then there was a study done after the Yom Kippur War where they followed a group of orphans who lost their father in the Yom Kippur War into adulthood, and they looked at what predicted which kids did better and which didn't. And it turned out the key predictor was how open their mothers were in crying in front of them and in sharing their pain with them as they went into adulthood, okay? And in allowing them to cry and express their sadness about what happened. Again, bring this down to the lower level of everyday parenting of adolescents, and it makes an enormous difference. So that's on that piece. And then obviously avoid terms like you have to be brave, and let's allow them to feel what they want to feel. And I already spoke about required helpless. Look, resilience is the norm. I've been working with abused kids, with kids. I just came back from over a week in Australia. I just got back from Australia. And they're coping with some tough times there in terms of some horrible large-scale abuse case there. And I've worked with abused kids when I was director of psychology at North Shore Hospital before I ended up in my current position. I was for many, many years working with kids who you think would never be able to survive. and kids who've gone through a lot of 9/11 kids. And the key point is that resilience is the norm. When I think about all the kids I worked with going back 25 years or more, I'm afraid to count. I think it's a little more than 25 years. Anyway, more like 27, 28. Almost all of them made it as long as they had the three ingredients that I'm talking about. And at a lower level, that's what we're talking about with our kids. It's the how are you doing? You know, it's the giving them words, it's the validating, and it's the other two ingredients I talked about. Let's hear. So let's finish it up. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question, but I wouldn't. I wouldn't, because it means that's the way they're, that's their style. It means that they may have maybe a little bit, I opened up by talking about that opening story with the various ways of coping. So if you have a kid who's a distractor, it doesn't mean he or she is Cal. I imagine it's, is it a he or is it a she? Whatever. Okay. He or she, doesn't matter, doesn't matter. It doesn't mean they're callous, and it doesn't mean they don't care, and it may mean they have to get a little bit older, and that's fine. I wouldn't be worried about it at all. Again, that's the whole idea. And by the way, they may be dealing better with that, and it doesn't mean they don't care. I'd worry about their not caring because of it. If everybody else in the school is involved in some kind of chesed project related to what's going on, and they're not.
No, if the school has a program, and that always brings out that, you know, because usually they do well.
That's totally fine. I think that's a very good point. That's exactly the point I'm trying to make. If a kid seems unaffected, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're not affected. It just means that this is the way they're wired, and you have to respect that. And sometimes it's kids like that who can be mobilized to do incredible things. So yeah, totally accept. It's totally fine, and it doesn't speak to a callousness. There's a difference between callousness and a coping style. That's why I open with that. It's the first of the three main points I wanted to make. Yeah, but thank you. That's an excellent point. Other points that anybody wants to make here or whatever?
Yeah. The economy. It's tough times. That makes money just comes from the trees, keeps on going. Spend, doesn't understand why you can't. Do everything.
Right.
Call that a Jewish teenager.
That's right. So there, that's again totally fine. They don't have to accept the reality, and that's again part of what adolescents are about. They tend to be very egocentric. They tend to be like Rabbi Fogel says. It tends to be part of what the typical Jewish teenager does for a living. It doesn't matter what they say. It matters whether they listen to you about the restrictions you're putting on them. So if you're putting restrictions on them, like, you know, because of this, I can't pay for this, or we're not going to be able to take you on the winter break that you may have been accustomed to, or it may mean that you can't buy this for Hanukkah or that for Hanukkah, and they go nuts on you, fine, let them go nuts. There's a great pasuk in Mishle. It says, Yasser bin Chokesh, Chikvah vil Hamisol Titi Namshech, which means put limits on your kids, don't worry about it, don't pay attention to their yelling and screaming. So the Medrash on that pasuk says, Kol Hamosiv Av Yisurim Al Bano, Mosiv HaBen Av Al Aviv. The more a father puts limit on his son, the more that son will love the father. It may not show it right away, but that's fine. They don't have, confuse liking it with accepting it. As long as, now, if he doesn't accept it, then it means you don't have tight enough controls over the finances. In other words, you know, so let them complain, let them drive you crazy, and you could develop a certain amount of deafness to their driving you crazy. Hear them out once or twice, and then you just refuse to talk. I say, look, I don't have the money, or this isn't the right time for it. It's wrong in such tough times to do A, B, or C. And if they go nuts on you, let them go nuts. They say, well, my friends are allowed to. First of all, I've yet to meet that friend. You know, kids have been talking to me. I thought I'd meet them in Australia, you know, this past week. It's as far away as you could go in the world as you possibly, it's as far away from this spot as you could possibly be. I gave 16 talks there. Okay? They talk about the friend. You know, the friend. They have the friend there also. So, I wouldn't worry. I mean, it sounds very normal, and it sounds like just allow it. Right? It's certainly you have experience with that with your students, right?
What?
in terms of kids complaining, not accepting, or whatever. Yeah, you know, and where parents get in trouble is where they either give the kids too much power over the finance, they give them a credit card, or they don't have a carefully titrated out budget with a careful allowance. That's a separate talk. The talk about adolescence and money, which is actually much easier than meets the eye, because you're really in total control over it. You decide it. So you try to listen to them. You try to be as reasonable as you can. But it's always dictated by resources. You either have it or you don't have it. If you don't have it, you're not going to be able to get it for them. And the fact that they're upset about it, who says that's part of good parenting? It's that sometimes your kids get upset. It's, if I could construct a world for my kids where they never have to be frustrated, it would be a disaster. Frustration is the engine of growth. Feeling like you don't have actually is growth-inducing. There's a beautiful, and with this maybe, it sounds like we're about to totally end, unless there's some other points, beautiful Medrash Tehillim that many of you may have heard, but it's a great way to end this. It says, Ilu nafalti lo kanti, ilu yashafti b'choshech lo hayarli. It says, if I never fell, I never would have gotten up. If I didn't sit in darkness, I never would have experienced light. And that's, in fact, what everything shows. That even if there are tough times coming our way, and hopefully it won't affect us nearly as badly as some of the pundits are predicting, okay? But it says that, look, it's an engine of growth. It's an engine of growth. I don't worry about these things because I've seen kids go through horrific, horrific times. When you spend your day in the trenches with kids who just lost a father or mother in the World Trade Center, or with kids who lost limbs in a pigua, or with kids who see a father kill a mother, as I've unfortunately had to work with four or five times in my career. So when you work with that and you see how resilience is the norm, that's why I usually try to say no to these kind of speaking engagements, but I like doing it because I like hearing normal sometimes. It's nice to hear normal, you know? It's nice to hear normal kinds of concerns, you know? Okay, so thank you, everybody, and best of luck to you all.